Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host Eagle One. I want to thank everybody for joining us for another live edition of Midrats. And if you are new to the show and you want to catch up on previous shows, or if you happen to have to leave halfway through and you want to catch the other half of the show, you can always get the archive over Blog Talk Radio or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And occasionally with our guests, we will go longer than an hour. If you're with us live, of course, it will end, but it keeps going in the archive. So you can pop in later and you'll be able to catch the last few minutes of the show. And a good way to find out about that is if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, for those who are with us live, you can join the chat room with the usual suspects. And if you have some questions or points of order you'd like to bring into the show, or if you think there's a question that we really need to direct towards our guest that it doesn't look like we're headed to, that's a great place to roll it in. It's in the chat room. Eagle One and I will both be monitoring it during the show, and we'll try to fold in those things as we go forward. Now let's get on with the show. And our topic today kind of folds in two things, I think, and I'll try to bring that up in a question, is what's more important in an organization, to address a crisis in leadership or a culture that allows that leadership crisis to take place? Are they both related? Can you do one without the other? And how do you create an environment that enables those within it to innovate, to improve, and to change not just themselves, but the organization they serve? In the military, it's an organization that more often than not, it prizes a type A personality. It needs the risk taker. It needs a strong intellect. But almost in opposite to that, it demands silence. It demands order. It demands compliance. And it demands often for those strong type A personalities to do things that they greatly disagree with. So when that takes place, where is that proper? Where is that improper? And are we taking full advantage of the type of personality set that we say we really want in this line of work? And our guest to discuss for the full hour will be Peter Munson. He's a Marine officer, KC-130 aircraft commander. He's a Middle East specialist blogger. He's also author of the book, Iraq in Transition, The Legacy of Dictatorship and the Prospects for Democracy. And he is also editor over at Small Wars Journal. And we're going to use an article of his that came out in Small Wars Journal back in April titled Disruptive Thinkers, Defining the Problem, in a response to Lieutenant Benjamin Coleman's essay, The Military Needs More Disruptive Thinkers. And if you haven't read those, you can all find links for them over at the show page, or you can go over to Small Wars Journal and search them up for yourself. But until then, Peter, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and greatly appreciate the offer to be able to talk about this.
Well, it's a topic that has really gotten a lot of interest by our regular listeners, and also some people that may be new to the program that have been in touch with us on a variety of ways. And I wanted to kick things off, Peter, quoting from your article here, because I think you rounded out the question really well. And you know, over the last 6 to 8 weeks or so, maybe you have a different view on it. But in the earlier part of your essay, Disruptive Thinkers, Defining the Problem, you quoted one of your commenters, Noel Hypothesis, who said, what you're really looking at is what is the problem we are trying to solve again? And you say, that is the right question. And if we have disruptive thinkers, what are they trying to disrupt?
Okay. I think I'd just like to start with talking about what exactly are we trying to get at with disruptive thinkers? And, you know, the catchphrase, I think comes from, you know, I haven't exhaustively researched this, but I think, you know, it's been around in different circles or in different formats on the business side and, you know, science side. But Ben Coleman used it in his article with Small Wars Journal in this context first. And there's been some criticism of that because, you know, a lot of people say that it detracts from, you know, the reform message because the disruptive catchphrase, you know, makes people in a somewhat risk-averse bureaucracy a little bit, you know, a little bit worried and makes them want to resist that. And so, you know, I think that the reason why he used disruptive thinkers and why I kind of try to make it a tagline at Small Wars Journal is because, yeah, it does shake up the culture. It does. It is a little bit shocking. You know, it's marketing, honestly. If we published an article that said the military needs innovative thinkers or something like that, everyone would be like, well, yeah, no kidding. But so is it marketing? Yes, it's marketing. But I think what it is that there's a problem that everyone recognizes because there's been a plethora of articles out there talking about innovation and reform and yada, yada, yada. But nothing really happens. And so, you know, I think it's an attempt to try to, you know, shake the bureaucracy a little bit and get it to pay attention. And in my own writing previous to this, I've written a couple articles at the Marine Corps Gazette. And in one article, actually a letter to the editor, I stated that they have an advertisement that said that the Marine Corps Gazette is read by every general officer. And I wrote, well, I think that that needs to be changed, that you know, every general officer has a subscription because they must not be reading, because otherwise they surely would either comment, let us know why we are missing something, or they would, you know, they would do something about the things that the you know, this middle management level is talking about. And Lieutenant General Robert Neller, who's currently Director of Operations on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he's actually going to be coming down to my neck of the woods at MARSENT here soon, he, as he said, took the bait, and in a series of back and forth between him and some other folks at the Marine Corps, has called us the Young Turks. And in all of these back and forth, I think that there's a little bit of a, on the side of the middle management, there's a little bit of an overstatement of the problem, a little bit of, you know, attempt to jar the system. And on the other side, kind of the guardians of the system, institutional leadership, those who do actually roger up or, you know, make comments, a lot of times the disruptive thinkers or a call for innovation, a call for reform, it's kind of attacked with a, you know, straw man arguments, saying, well, you guys just want to have nothing but resources thrown at you and no accountability, or you expect to be able to come in as a first lieutenant and, you know, to not have to listen to orders and just innovate and go off on your own and do whatever you want. And I think that's absolutely not the case, at least what most of I think the responsible voices are arguing for. It's really, and getting back to your the way you split it into two possible categories, this is a crisis in leadership that we have to deal with by going after the leadership aspect of it, or do we need to go after the culture that allows it? I really do think it's the culture that we need to get at, and it's really, I think, the culture that the disruptive thinkers and other similar arguments, to include the attrition's letters in the Marine Corps Gazette, include some of the stuff that I've written there and at my own blog, and just a kind of a really around the, you know, the defense literature, things like Colonel Paul Yingling. It's an issue of the culture that needs to be changed so that the leadership can be changed. Because really, the leaders are bred, born, and brewed in that culture. And if you don't change the culture, you can just try to change out leaders, and you're never going to get to the result you want to.
Well, that opens up a lot of areas for discussion. Let's talk about changing the culture. I mean, what I guess my assumption is that one of the theories behind the way things are now is that many of the more senior officers have been co-opted into a system that ignores the present realities, and that the one function of disruptive thinking is to give them some ground truth as to way things look from as you say, the middle management or the lower management area. Am I off base in thinking that way?
Well, I think that I don't think you're off base in thinking that way, but you know, I want to be careful, because another one of the straw man arguments that's been thrown up against this line of thinking is that we think that we know better than everybody else, we being the younger generation, and really people try to say that, you know, we're so inexperienced that we don't even know what we're arguing about, that we have a very simplistic view of the world, and that we're trying to tell people for 30 plus years of experience the way things are when we don't get it ourselves. And so a couple quick points on that. One, you know, a lot of the people who are writing these things are not quite as inexperienced as some of the commenters would lead you to believe. You know, it's a bit of a minefield, because, you know, if I say that I have 15 years of experience in the institution, then, you know, some people would say, well, that's a lot, and others would say it's not that much. But there's people like myself who are, you know, I've already passed my 04 level, basically, MOS tour. I've worked at that level. We've got others who are, you know, commanding officers at the battalion level who feel the same way. We've got others at the 06 level who are also making some of these arguments, at least, if not out in the open, then, well, you know, you have Paul Yingling and Colonel John Gentile who are making these out in the open, but there's plenty of others who are in contact with people like me who say that, yes, we're on the right path. And, you know, even into the general officer levels, Lieutenant General Miller didn't exactly agree with us, but he didn't exactly say that we were wrong either. So I do think that there's a difference in perception of what's going on in the institution between the lower and mid levels and the highest levels of the institution. But I think, more importantly, that this is something that it's not isolated with defense bureaucracy or the U.S. military. This is something that can be expected as a bureaucracy kind of gets to a point where it's been very protected. It hasn't had basically to fight for its life, whether economically or militarily, for some time. And it's kind of on top of the heap. You know, the bureaucracy tends to get bloated. It tends to be problems and dysfunction and really a lot of inefficiencies in the bureaucracy. And some of the things that I've written about try to highlight that, I guess, comparison between, say, the DOD and, you know, HP or a Xerox, you know, that was near the end of its, you know, its plain paper copying monopoly, which I guess.
Yeah, I just wanted to double down on something you said. I think one of the, you talk about anti-intellectualism, the people that the first thing they do is come out and take out the calendar and say, well, I have this many more years than you, therefore my argument wins. That's just a classic defensive of not really wanting to address the issue. And I thought, and usually when people do that, I just tune them out because they don't know what they're doing. When I was reading Benjamin Coleman's article, I was reminded back my first real shore duty job back in the mid to late 90s, a little gaggle that I was with that had some really, really sharp individuals, and one of them actually got out and got his MBA from Harvard. But by the end of the 90s, besides me and one other guy, this group of 10 people, you know, pre-internet, they're all gone. They all got out of the service. And I've heard some of what, you know, you've heard as well, where people are kind of reacting to this in a less than productive way, where they weigh in on the argument as if this is a criticism or a challenge to senior leadership. I kind of see it exactly the opposite. I see it almost a plea for senior leadership to do what needs to be done to address some very real problems that I think those who are closest to it, which are those who have gotten through their first sea duty and have had time to reflect because they're fully qualified and they actually have some more operational experience. And you have guys like you that may only have 15 years in, but you've probably worked more with Marines in the way a Marine officer could in the last 15 years. A lot of these guys have in 30, and that's operationally. Do you see that as well, that it's not so much of a challenge of leadership of a bunch of young Turks complaining, but almost a plea for the good senior leaders we have there to come to the fore and come out into the open?
I think absolutely it's a plea. And as a matter of fact, that's why some of the calls have gotten a little bit more strident, I guess you could say, is because we're trying to get a response, trying to create a dialogue whereby the senior leadership comes out and either says, hey, this is what you're missing, or we hear you, we're working on it, you know, here's what we've done, and here's what we're going to do. So that's on one hand. And on the other hand, at least in my the things that I've been writing and you know, discussing with people, it's not so much it's not so much an issue of tactical combat, leadership, command and control. This is really, for me, more about the bureaucracy, the institutional level leadership, and the issues of just how we train and equip our forces, how we manage our people back home, the sorts of burdens that we put on people that detract from our you know, our core missions. And, you know, I don't want to really get into this realm here, but I would also say the way that our bureaucracy writ large makes strategic decisions and, you know, conducts strategic level operations. So that I've addressed that issue in brief for instance, in Foreign Policy magazine. But really it's about how the bureaucracy makes decisions, allocates resources, and most importantly, prioritizes the efforts of the people that are working for you. So, you know, is it if I'm working at a given geographic combatant command, is it more important for me to focus on those things which support the warfighter, or is it more important for me to do firefighter or fire extinguisher training on the computer? And that is a choice that people are forced to make because there are no priorities given, and there's just a list of you have to do all of this. And by the way, there's not enough time in the day. So then people start to make up their own priorities, which are not always consistent with, you know, mission accomplishment.
Eagle One, going once, going twice. Ah, well, we all live in the Southeast. Somebody got, wait, did he dial back in? Eagle One, is that you?
Yeah, I'm here.
There we go. A little technical difficulty. My apologies. Yep,
okay.
We got you. Your question.
Yeah, my question is has to do with whether we've gone a long way toward making, it sounds like, the military friendly as we can. You know, and a complaint I had when I was a junior officer, and I'm sure one that continues today, that the customer and this of the bureaucracy. The junior officer, the middle management, and we've done everything we can to make their job as hard as possible while making it easier for the bureaucracy to operate. Is some of the effort that you see going on with this process of communication devoted to that kind of issue?
Okay, I missed a little bit of that. I'm not sure if it was my end or your end, but my understanding was that you were asking if the bureaucracy has basically made life easier for itself and transferred more burdens onto the lower level operators. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Well, in a way, I do think that that's correct. A lot of the things that you'll see complaints about is kind of the tyranny of higher headquarters, the higher headquarters' ability to reach farther and farther down into the tactical level weeds. And you know, this is true both in combat operations and back at home station. So you can see, of course, you can see people anywhere around the world looking over the shoulder of a fire team leader via Predator live feed. You can also see higher headquarters wanting to know which Lance Corporal's done his motorcycle training and which Lance Corporal has not. And I can see reasons why at some points in time this is appropriate. Certain levels of intrusive leadership can be appropriate at certain times, but it has become so easy for the higher levels to reach down that there's this appetite, this demand for information to come up the chain, and it's just assumed that it's so easy to put that together. Maybe it's not assumed, but the demand is there for us to put this information together, that we spend more time reporting statistics up the chain than we do getting feedback back from, the higher levels, and almost more time reporting than actually doing the things that we should be reporting on, actually conducting these tactical level tasks, whether it's, actual combat or garrison issues. So there's been a lot, there's a profusion of data systems out there, there's a profusion of data calls out there, and there hasn't, again, been a move to really examine how much time and how much of a burden those things are placing on the lower level of the institution, and how to rationalize these things. And I guess one more point on that is that, with these different data systems that are coming out, individually a lot of them are meant to make life easier for the lower level commands. If you pour all this data into the system, it's going to populate all these reports for you. But what the institution doesn't do is, what ends up happening is that we'll have two or three different data systems that we have to put different sets of data into so instead of rationalizing, it ends up multiplying. And then we still get a demand for certain kinds of reports that we manually enter, and because the institution hasn't caught up to the data systems that it's created. So, for instance, if we're doing computer-based training, there's now systems where all of the certificates get, are electronically available, and all the statistics can go up through the through that electronic system to give numbers to higher headquarters. However, you still got a clerk having us print off all of our certificates, fill out the Excel spreadsheet, and send it up the chain, in addition to this new electronic reporting system. So it's again, the bureaucracy needs to rationalize and prioritize our efforts, I think.
That's a perfect lead in to another ball I wanted to tee up for you that I thought you addressed real well in your article, because I think it's underappreciated. And we had an interesting statistic pop out a while ago, maybe a topic for a different show, about the ratio of non-operational naval officers versus operational naval officers with regard to their designator and their numbers. I think the Marine Corps is a lot better than we are. But one thing we've all seen, and even though we've heard people rail against it, but it's gotten worse, that is staff bloat in both size and number of staffs. You look at what a staff was 15 years ago, 20 years ago, with less technology, you would think with technology you would have fewer people on the staff. That's not true. And then we have multiple layers of bureaucracy doing the classic staff weenie bleat of, I need to chop the chop of the chop. And there's something about that that I think in the culture within these multiple layers of staffs that goes against one of my favorite phrases, is creative friction, that you need opposition, you need argument, you need disagreement, because it's only through that aggressive exchange of ideas in the open, preferably, you can get closer to the solution. But we have a habit in staffs of socializing proposal in order to get a buy-in from everybody else before you actually go forward with a concept. So there is no creative friction. If you could please talk a little bit about your thoughts about that buy-in concept and how the solutions provided at the beginning.
Okay, that's a great question set, and honestly, there's so many things I want to say about this, but I'm not sure where to start. So, your point about the proliferation of non-operational, non-operational to operational, and the way the staffs are growing, General Zinni spoke of this as the self-licking ice cream cone, and in one of my blog posts, I related it to Gordon Gekko from Wall Street when he goes to Teldar Paper and we got a hot mic, or is that my phone? Okay, that's better. I don't know if that was me or someone else. Okay. So, relating it to Gordon Gekko from Wall Street, the movie Wall Street, and he goes into Teldar Paper and he says, we've got 30 vice presidents, and I've been studying this company for, 6 months, and I can't figure out what they do except for send memos from one guy to the next. And so, again, it highlights that this is not some evil facet of military bureaucracy. This is what happens in corporations, organizations that, have been in a position where they haven't had a clean house. They've been at a resource advantaged position. And there's a book by Richard Rommel, I believe I'm getting the name right, called Good Strategy, Bad Strategy. And he speaks to different case studies of how this happens in different bureaucracies. And, if you don't have some sort of, wildfire that comes through and clears out the underbrush, that stuff starts to choke off growth. In the corporate world, there's the business cycle tends to take care of that. Either companies periodically have to reform, reset, let people go, and kind of streamline themselves down, or they're going to end up going out of business. In the Department of Defense, it's a different animal because it doesn't have those same competitive pressures. Yes, we're at war, but we're not sending battalion against battalion, division against division, where, like you saw in World War II, you would have, several layers of leadership fired or killed until you get to the point where, the organization is working optimally. I'm not, wishing for that sort of thing, but if you don't have that sort of dynamic occurring naturally, then you need to start looking for how do we basically start to clear out this undergrowth of staff proliferation that's really tending to make the bureaucracy very inefficient. I got a couple notes that I wrote down as you were talking. I'll just hit a couple of them real briefly before I go on to, discuss why I think this is important. First off, you mentioned how the Navy has maybe more non-operational to operational officer billets, but the Marine Corps has been using individual augments. I know all the services have, but we've been growing our staffs by basically robbing out of our operational units to send people on augment tours to those staffs. So we're all seeing it, and in the Marine Corps it's, I think, particularly harmful. There's a certain level at which there's room for that sort of augmentation, and there's need for it. But once you go past the, we're on a wartime footing, we need to increase our staffs a little bit, to the staff bloat, you're really creating a harmful situation. And another example of that I saw from walking around the halls of CENTCOM is that there's a tasker cell in the J-5. And so, my understanding of that is that there's basically an office with several people in it whose sole job is to keep track of all the tasks that everyone is supposed to be doing. So, these things are so, you can see that, the self-licking ice cream cone. And so when you get this profusion of different interests in a bureaucracy, that's where you get that need for buy-in. And so, everybody is defending their interest. It's not necessarily that people are being purposely nefarious. It's the nature of the bureaucracy. You think the job that you're doing is important, So therefore, you think you need more resources to do it well. And if you don't have someone to rationalize and prioritize, you get all these people competing to protect their piece of the pie. And as that goes on, everyone starts to, you know, basically log roll where they're, you know, as decisions get passed around through the system, through different sorts of means of routing, every decision gets watered down to get that buy-in to the point where it's not a decision at all. And again, that's where we lead to these, we get to the situation where we're at, where there's no prioritization of time, investment, resources, et cetera, because of this, you know, this basically set of, you know, interest groups gone wild.
Well, I guess one of the questions then is, how do you select? If you're gonna weed things out in the business world, you can do it on the basis of productivity or you know, income generated or a whole bunch of other means of measuring performance. They may not be great, but they're at least methods of doing so. Now we use a fitness report system that I think is broken, and so everybody is above average. And how are we gonna weed out the people who are just holding their position, hoping for the retirement check, and how are we going to keep people who are dynamic, disruptive thinkers to move us forward? How does that work?
Well, you know, that's the multi-million-dollar question that I don't necessarily have the you know, the silver bullet answer for, but there's two different answers to how do you select, how do you go about figuring out, you know, who are the right people to keep around, and what organizations and organizational methods are the right ones to keep around. And you hit on, you know, the bottom line in your question is that there are no metrics. So we talk about metrics, we try to create metrics, but there really are no metrics in the Department of Defense right now that can truly basically rationalize our system. We don't have a customer, and you can argue different. You can argue for different people who are customers, but really, when you come down to it, there's no one who's going to be able to walk away and not buy our product in the end game. So we don't have a customer. You know, our budget is fixed, and the system for, allocating resources to the Department of Defense is not a rational system. So therefore, it's not gonna choke out inefficiencies. Again, we're not in existential battle where there's a metric of are you winning or losing against a peer competitor, and there's not the threat of that nearby. So that's another, I guess, influence that could drive a more rational performance that we're missing. And as far as, you know, some of the personnel policies that we have go, there's no payroll tax. There's no, you know, you don't have to worry about your payroll. So you can be as inefficient with your manpower as you want to be, and there's nothing to rationalize that. So if we're keeping people, having people work for 40 hours a week or 80 hours a week, or if we've got people there 40 hours a week and they're not doing anything for us, there's no one, you know, there's no sort of payroll cost or overtime cost for the majority of the Department of Defense that's going to make you use your people more intelligently. So these are all things that make, I think, leadership and culture that more important to fixing the problems that we see. But I'm not really that optimistic that, you know, that a answer or a solution is going to materialize. So as far as how do we select the right people to stay around, again, there's a lot of literature out there on different ways that we can move ahead, whether that's, you know, a lot of this is tied up in the laws for military compensation, the laws for military promotion and selection, and I'm not an expert on those by any means, but it's not as simple as just changing the way that we select, promote, retain, and pay people. We have to go to Congress to release some of that. But I think that what we could do, somehow try to make our fitness reporting system a little bit better, you know, right now there's things like where you just can't say anything negative about a person, where on a Marine Corps fit rep, if I write, this is an average captain, this is an average sergeant in a fit rep, and average comes up in the software as a keyword that the fit rep should be adverse. So we're saying that if we say someone is average, then this is an adverse fit rep. It just makes no sense. People have talked a lot of different ideas how we could do 360-degree fit reps. But really, there's a lot. You know, there's a lot of logistical problems with how do we do that? How do we change the fit rep system? So I guess I'm almost arguing against myself when I say it's going to have to start at the top, where the people at the very top of the institution are going to have to force a sea change. So I guess it is leadership that's very important, but what they need to change is the culture. And so I've got myself a little bit of circular logic here where, how do we change the culture? Someone at the top is going to have to initiate that. But in order to ensure that we have the right leadership at the top, the culture has to be changed.
Let me throw you a life preserver here, because this is a perfect segue into my next question that I think you'll be able to pick up and run with, because I'm in complete agreement with you here. The key, as it is with most things, is you've got to have the right leadership. But I think you've described real well, both here and in other places, that our organization, I'm a home blog, and occasionally when I'm describing this, I put up a picture of the Janissaries if anybody wants to study what happens when a military organization ceases to be useful. There are these adhesions that we have in our culture, in our leadership, how we select people. But this isn't new. I mean, our military has gone through this before. Throughout recorded military history, other militaries have. What you need is something to break the adhesions. And one thing during a pre-show discussion with a little cabal I gathered up over at Facebook, we were talking about, what I mentioned before, what we need here is this is going to be solved by existing three stars and four stars. This is going to require people in civilian suits, political appointees who have a broad axe and a mandate to do something within living memory was actually done. I like to go back in the Eisenhower era, for the chief of naval operations, Arleigh Burke was pulled down from one star to be CNO, bypassing a couple of hundred people, I think it was, in order to break those adhesions and to bring in some new blood. Is that... Well, we're all here looking for somebody to move here, and I don't think we have the general officer and flag officer culture to allow a Tom Connolly to self-immolate for the sake of his organization. But is the real solution here to get the right civilian leadership in DOD that will make these adhesion-breaking movements that might have good second- and third-order effects? We can impact the culture and move towards a better construct.
Well, I'm going to have to try to be careful here, because I think that this is treading a little bit into, you know, civil military relations, and it's something that's critically important. But you know, I'm an active duty military officer, so I need to be very careful, and not cross the line of basically.
I was just, in general terms, yeah. I'm not interested in one party or another, just as a general concept. I wasn't trying to bring in that briar patch. I'm sorry if it sounded like it. I wasn't.
No, absolutely not. It just, I wouldn't want to even go into, even if I could speak freely, I wouldn't want to go and try to partisan political finger point, because I think that's part of the problem, is that it's on all of America's political entities that, everyone, uses, both sides use things like the military and defense decision making as a football to kick around and then finger point, at the other side on decisions that they themselves might have made. But, it's the constant game of gotcha. So that's an aspect of our political culture that is definitely detrimental to fixing anything. with the federal government. But I mean, my point is, I'm really thinking, you know, I have to think through this very carefully as I speak. So, as far as getting the right civilian leadership in place, I think that that is absolutely critical, and I think that that is a place where, you know, there could be a you know, a shakeup that's brought by, you know, brought in by kind of an outside party, or maybe an insider who's actually an outsider, if you know what I mean, you know, someone who's a bit of a maverick and put into the right position. However, the aspects of our political culture and our civil-military relations right now that work against that. One I just spoke to, which is the, you know, kind of the gridlock. And I've got another book that's coming out in January. It's called War, Welfare, and Democracy, and it speaks to how, you know, not just in the United States, but in Europe too, there's a polarization of political culture, as we also start to see somewhat of a polarization of, you know, kind of the economic structure of our country. And again, this is one of those things that's kind of like the military, where the military dysfunction that I've described, you know, as these institutions kind of keep growing in a certain direction without any crisis to remake them, you get the special interests that proliferate and kind of choke out the rational functioning of the system. You have that in the military. You also have that in the, you know, political machinery of our government and other governments in the world. So it is all part of a, you know, different facets of a interrelated problem. But as far as getting the right civilian leadership to start to kind of take an axe to the bureaucracy, another aspect of that is that we've had these, you know, this decade of war, and we've had this war where there's a small population, you know, subpopulation of our citizenship that's been party to this war, that's actually, you know, been part of the war. And so our, you know, there, we have very strong civilian supporters out there who, you know, want to honor the sacrifices that are made, want to make sure that the military is getting everything that it needs to do its job. But at the same time, I think it's created a bit of a culture of self-entitlement on the part of the military. We've told ourselves for 10 years that look at all the sacrifices we've made, look at what we've done, and that really hurts our ability to have some introspection, you know, within the bureaucracy. But it also makes it incredibly difficult for someone to come in and start to take an axe to the bureaucracy, because, you know, those parties that are getting axed are going to kind of wave the bloody shirt and say, you know, you're cutting something that is going to eventually make, you know, people die on the battlefield. There's a great parody in The Onion about General. It's supposedly it's General Mattis, but you know, it's a satire, and he's writing saying that we have to have, the only way we're going to win the war is if we have a pinball machine at CENTCOM. And you know, everything that we do, people try to use that sort of logic, say we have to have X, Y, or Z program or institution in order to win the war, or as the war starts to wind down, in order to prevent, you know, another war from happening. So with that civil-military relationship, with that you know, kind of culture of self-entitlement on the military's part, it's going to be very difficult for someone to kind of rationally take an axe to the organization and try to chop off those parts that kind of need to be regrown or to go away altogether. And so I think my thought is that both on the political side, you know, writ large, and then in the subset of what's going to happen with the military in the future, I don't see us rationally addressing our own issues. I think it's going to take a crisis that's going to force, you know, drastic measures that will eventually, you know, that's the wildfire, that if you don't do a prescribed burn, the wildfire comes through. It doesn't really differentiate between, you know, between parts of the forest. It just takes it all down, and you got to rebuild. Now, I don't think that the crisis will be quite that bad, but I do think that you know, there may be a crisis that requires, you know, that really damages our finances, our governmental institutions, and our fiscal policy, and we have to kind of rebuild after that. It you know, unless we can find some way to compromise and to come up with a solution to stave that off, but I don't see that happening in the near term.
Let me shift the focus a little bit to a guy that I think was a disruptive thinker and that we've discussed many times here before, and we'll discuss again, especially if I can get General Van Riper back on. But let's talk about John Boyd. I mean, a lot of the approach he took to things was not necessarily the highly recommended approach to advancement to general officer pay, but he certainly had influence. Is he a factor, you think, in the direction that this disruptive thinking idea has taken?
Well, I think he's a bit of a factor, but I don't think it's quite at least not for me. And I don't really think I can know enough about others' ideas and motivations to speak for them. So I think he's definitely an influence, but we're not trying to consciously follow in his footsteps. But I mean, really, the important idea there, the important idea there is that do you want to advance to general, or do you want to do what you think is right, and to to try to advocate for change in an organization that you care about? And again, we get a lot of bad press from some sectors saying, we're just publicity seekers and, we're trying to make a name for ourselves. But, trying to call out general officers and basically provoke them into dialogue, like you said, is not the safe route to general officer. Criticizing aspects of the bureaucracy that some people have very high affinity for, it's not throughout the general officer. So I fall back to what my platoon commander, when I was at the basic school, what he said to us, and that was, people talk about dying for their country all the time, but no one ever says anything about giving their career for their country. So, I'm not out to commit career suicide, but I think that, people are a little bit too concerned about, some people are a little too concerned about their careers, and that definitely does hurt the calls for reform from within. And it's also, it's a carrot and a stick that's used against people who would step out and say things. But on that note, I'm pretty outspoken. I have gotten very little in the way of negative feedback from the organization. Part of that is because, maybe I'm not that well known, and a lot of the stuff, that even goes on in Smallworth's Journal or the Marine Corps Gazette blog doesn't necessarily get seen by all the parties that headquarters Marine Corps. But at the same time, some of the stuff that people like me and Ben Coleman and others have said about the institution, if we were, executives at XYZ Corporation or, mid-level managers at XYZ Corporation, we said the same thing about their corporate culture, we'd be gone the next day. So there is a tolerance for dissent and professional discussion. Unfortunate thing is that, it's sometimes just a bit of an outlet in these forums become an echo chamber that don't really result in any action.
Let me bring back another topic from Benjamin Coleman's original article that I found fascinating. It's one of my favorite topics. We had a show about a year and a half ago with Vice Admiral Miller and Victor Davis Hanson, the topic of the show was the intellectual education of military leaders. But what we really focused on was the pre-commissioning, your academy guys, your NROTC, OCS, young men and women, before their mid-20s who are coming into service, what's a good way to intellectually educate them in breadth and depth to prepare them, at least intellectually, for where they're going. But one thing that Benjamin brought up and other people have written about it has been the insufficiency of our professional military education, whether you talk about our war colleges or one thing that I just absolutely cannot stand, the whole JPME process, but talking about, you know, sending people off to major institutions, civilian institutions for education to acculturate them to both the civilian world and also to let some of our civilian leaders get to know serving officers, something I've always been a great fan of. But one thing that I've seen a lot of people have, and I want to see what your take on this, there are exceptions. I think Admiral Stavridis is an exception. I think General Mattis is an exception. I think that Admiral Harvey is an exception. But there is a fair bit of anti-intellectualism in the military from two parts. One, those who just think a bunch of book learning is no good in mid-career because you ought to be doing other things like preparing PowerPoint. Yes, I'm a little cynical there. But there's also one thing that a lot of people have run into that have had opportunities where you get the call in by the chief of staff or the first flag officer chain of command in your community and tells you, you don't want to do that. That's not career enhancing. You're going to blow your ride if you go do that. Do you see a regular current of anti-intellectualism like that still in our military, or is that isolated in general personalities or specific personalities?
I'm gonna say, before I say what I'm gonna say, everyone needs to listen for the nuance that I'll say after it. But there is a pervasive culture of anti-intellectualism in the military, and I'll kind of get back to that. You know, so that's my tagline. I'll get back to that in a minute. But let me say, in my own experience, I'm a foreign area officer. So I went to the Naval Post Graduate School, which I thought was a fantastic education. You know, I really enjoyed it. I learned a tremendous amount. I didn't get to cross-pollinate with a lot of civilian, outside of DOD, civilian students. We did have some international students, both from uniformed military and departments of defense and a few other departments. And, you know, we had outstanding civilian educators, to include, at the time I was there, Dr. Valerie Nasser, who's a renowned Iran expert, was teaching at MPS at the time. So in my experience, I had the opportunity to do some great academic, tour. And also along with the FAO program, the Marine Corps has certainly, and I think some all the services to different extents have recognized the importance of that academic intellectual background and have tried to promote it, again, to different extents between the services. There is definitely I don't want to say lip service, but the institution is promoting the importance of education. And there's different initiatives out there to try to make it better. But there's still a pervasive culture of anti-intellectualism. I'm sure most of the listeners who are associated with the military have gone to some forum and heard a senior officer. I haven't heard it from general officers as much as I've heard it from more lieutenant major through colonel. Someone getting up in front of an audience and saying, the military sent me to get a master's degree, but I'm still not a very smart man, and all these sort of self-denigrating things. And, it stems, one, from a culture where you don't want to self-promote too much, but it does stem from some sense of anti-intellectualism where you almost have to excuse yourself for having done graduate education. And two, and I think more importantly, when we talk about incentives and how incentives create, value in a culture, what's important to us. On my fitness report as a senior major looking at lieutenant colonel, right up top it has my height and weight, and especially in the Marine Corps, it is important that you stay fit and fit the mold of a Marine officer. And it has my PFT score, and again, it's important to be able to lead from the front, but those things are right at the top of my fitness report that everybody sees as they start to work down towards the more substantive parts. There's nothing in there about my academic or intellectual background until you get to the very end where there's a block for PME, and it's just a check block. When we go to, whether it's Naval Host Graduate School or Command and Staff, really it's almost a pass-fail course, and there's no real incentives given to excel at those schools. And so that takes a lot of the seriousness out of our education. I haven't gone back. I read recently that Admiral Nimitz stated something to the effect of that their PME at that point in time was so rigorous that, you know, when they got into World War II, they had a very good understanding of everything from the grand strategic down to the tactical level based on their very rigorous PME. And so they didn't get as many surprises as they might have if they didn't have that educational background. Now, I'm not sure how much of that is true and how education has changed from then to now, but that's something worth looking at. But really, until we incentivize, you know, high performance in, in academic, I guess, in our different PME schools, we're not going to get the importance in the culture that we do about, you know, for instance, physical fitness. I think everyone agrees to a certain extent that physical fitness is somewhat important. You know, depending on what role you're in, it has much more importance. For a military leader. But, you know, am I more concerned about whether my battalion commander or squadron commander can run a 3 miles in 18 minutes or if he has the intellectual ability to manage a large organization, to lead a large organization, and to understand the higher-level issues that we have to interact with? I'd rather he just passed the PFT and was outstanding on the intellectual side as it impacted his job. And then finally, the point about cross education. There was a lot of back and forth about how much we interact with civilians in our education and how we could go to outside institutions. There was a lot of attacking the examples of business schools, and to me, a lot of those comments showed the basic civil military relations problem that we have, where a lot of people in the military feel that we are better than the rest of society, we are better than, you know, the business school grads, et cetera. But we are so isolated in many ways that we don't know what we're comparing ourselves to. And I think that it would be outstanding if we could get more of a cross section of intellectual or of academic credentials in the military. Get out and see, all right, so what does Harvard Business School really teach? Is everyone going to be a investment banker that's, is rating corporations, or are there also people who are creating true wealth in America, you know, working in manufacturing or whatever coming out of Harvard Business School? How are different organizations attacking, managerial and leadership problems outside of the military? How are they addressing institutional reform? What sorts of crises have they dealt with, and how did they reshape the organization to deal with it? I mean, these are things that, the cross-pollination is incredibly important to any organization, any sector, and we're missing out by not doing a little bit more of it.
Eagle One?
Yeah, we've got about a minute. Can you hear me? We got about a minute left, and I want to thank you for being on. And what are you working on next? And are we going to hear more about disruptive thinking? And what else you got planned for us?
Well, in the near term, we're going to try to get more disruptive thinkers sorts of articles up at Small Wars Journal, and hopefully in the Marine Corps Gazette, we'll get some as well. So we're going to keep that thread going. But really the most important thing with that is dialogue, to have a dialogue and not a one-way podium and not only, one side of the argument. I'd like to see nuance on both sides. Also for me, in the next couple months, I'm getting, like I said before, getting ready to have my next book come out. It's going to address some of these issues both on the military side and kind of discuss, what is the strategic environment that we're looking at for the next couple decades, and that'll be out in January, called War, Welfare, and Democracy from Potomac Books. And so that I'm hoping is going to generate some discussion that, you know, hopefully I'll be able to really learn a lot from. And other than that, just keep grinding away down in Tampa and doing what I can in my local area to improve things.
Well, Peter, I tell you what, it's been a fast hour. That I always tell you, you've had a great show. You've been a great guest, and I really appreciate you taking time this afternoon to spend some time with us. And I look forward to your next book and talking to you again soon.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and it's been a pleasure. It's my first radio appearance, so hopefully I did okay, and it's definitely been very educational. Kind of showed me a few holes in my thoughts, so I'll keep working.
You did great, and thank you, Peter.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Peter, and thanks to everybody who joined us live or is listening to us on the archive. Next week, we're going to have a Father's Day Best Of show, and then on the 24th of June, our guest will be Wendell Minnick. He's the Asia Bureau Chief for Defense News. And I hope everybody has a great week and a great Navy and Marine Corps day.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy Old, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the strand and Piccadilly.